The six of Numbers really continues the theme of the cleansing of the camp of God, which was begun in chapter 5. And in this chapter, one special group is concentrated on, a group of men and women who were set apart in rather special ways for the Lord and for his service. This group is called the Nazarites, and along with the Rechabites, they stand out as a highly distinctive unit in Israel. The Nazarites, in fact, have a very long history in the Old Testament. Their name comes from the word Nazir, N-A-Z-I-R, which is a Hebrew word to separate. And right down through Israel's history, the Nazarites crop up in the nation, either explicitly as Nazarites proper, like the men and women in this chapter, or as groups of men and women who weren't called Nazarites, but who nevertheless took Nazarite vows upon themselves. For example, as far down in history as the 7th century BC, which was roughly 500 years after the book of Numbers, we read of Nazarites in the book of Amos. And there is a suggestion in Amos chapter 2 and verse 11 that the Nazarites were God's gift to the nation for a particular emergency. And in Amos chapter 2 and verse 11, we find God complaining about the way in which Israel had treated the Nazarites. Listen to these words. "And God said, I raised up some of your sons for prophets." In other words, these Nazarites had a prophetic word for the people. "And some of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not indeed so, O people of Israel? But you made the Nazarites drink wine. And you commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. And in fact, that was how they stopped the Nazarites prophesying, by giving them wine to drink." In other words, the children of Israel, and this was their sin, had plied these consecrated young men with drink and had wrecked their prophetic ministries. I cannot but recall here the story told me by a ministerial friend of mine some years ago about an uncle he had on his mother's side. And in his youth, this uncle was called by God to the ministry. And he was such a promising young man that he was given the opportunity to preach locally in Aberdeenshire. And one day he preached in this church, and after the service he came down into the vestry with the minister, and he said to the minister, "How did I do?" And the minister said, "Oh, well, it's all right. But how about a little dram, just to set a seal on things?" And the minister produced a bottle of whiskey. And although the boy did not drink, he was gradually prevailed upon by the minister. And do you know the outcome of that story? The man abandoned his call to the ministry, and he turned his back on Christian service, and he became an alcoholic. And he lived and died sodden with drink after a useless life. And that story lends a certain feeling to these words in Amos. I raised up some of your sons for prophets, and some of your young men for Nazarites, but you made the Nazarites drink wine. And you commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. And that's what happened with this man in Aberdeenshire. He didn't prophesy, and his life was a mess. If you, in fact, read through the long history of the Nazarites in the Old Testament, a very interesting fact emerges. It seems that there were two sorts of Nazarite. First of all, there were those whose consecration was a temporary affair. And that seems to be the kind of Nazarite mentioned in Numbers chapter 6. For a short period, these men and women gave themselves to that kind of lifestyle. And their Nazarite vows were upon them. And they were taken up, and they were laid down again after the period of separation was over and done with. And for a time, these temporary Nazarites were abstainers in the three ways mentioned in Numbers 6. And then after their vows had been performed, they went back again to normal life after a short period. But alongside these, there was a second group of Nazarites upon whom the vows of consecration lasted for a lifetime. And the most famous instance of a lifetime Nazarite was, of course, the judge Samson. In fact, his mother had to become a Nazarite while she was still carrying him. If you turn to Judges chapter 13, you'll read the story of the conception and the birth of Samson. Chapter 13 of Judges and verse 2. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, behold, you are barren and have no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. And therefore beware and drink no wine or strong drink, and eat nothing unclean. For lo, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Then the woman came and told her husband, a man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God, very terrible. Apparently, that's what angels looked like in those days, not like these silly little sugary fairies you find on Christmas cards. These are just toy angels, paper angels. The real angels were very frightening, and sometimes people confused them with God and bowed down in worship. Very terrible, she says. I did not ask him whence he was, and he did not tell me his name. But he said to me, behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then, drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. You see, she had to become a Nazarite while she was carrying him. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God. And these are the words, from birth to the day of his death. In other words, it was a lifelong separation to God. And the difference between these two kinds of Nazareth, Nazarite. See, I'm thinking of Jesus, and there's a verse in Matthew's Gospel which says, he shall be called a Nazarite. But it's a different word. It's Nazarite, from the Hebrew Nazar, to shave. And not Nazarite, from the Hebrew Nazir, to separate. So the wires are crossing inside my head. The difference between these two kinds of Nazarite consecration, the temporary consecration that we read of in number 6, and the permanent sort of consecration you read of in the case of Samson, I believe that the difference really has something to say about the temporary and the permanent consecrations which we find in the Christian life. You see, in the Christian life, some kinds of separation are required by God for a short spell. And then once our separation has been tested by abstinence from certain things, the Christian can go back again, like the Nazarites here, to a normal lifestyle. It's a temporary taking upon oneself of the spirit of the Nazarite. But there are other kinds of Christian separation that are lifelong affairs, as was the case with Samson. And that second kind of Christian consecration is a consecration that lasts until death. And perhaps we'll have time to say one or two things about the difference between these two kinds of consecration later on. Let's take a look then at number 6 and the three marks of the consecration in the Nazarite, starting from verse 3 and going down to verse 8. You notice the insistence on this word separation, climaxing in verse 8, all the days of his separation he is holy to the Lord. Now, there were three kinds of separation, and as far as I can see it, what we have here are three kinds of separation from and three kinds of confession to. You see, if it was just a case of separation from, then it would be a negative affair. I don't do this, I don't do that, and I don't do this. But it's positive, you see, as well. There is a word of confession in these three acts of separation. And when the man separated himself from X, he was, in fact, confessing from that something positive to the world. The first, of course, was the separation from intoxicating liquor in verse 3 onwards. He shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. And Christian scholars seem to think that the confessional part of this total abstinence is a double thing. First of all, it's a confession that the Nazarite loves the Lord his God with all his heart and mind and soul and will and strength. You see, even the mildest indulgence in alcoholic beverage means that however imperceptibly. You cannot serve God with all your mind. It is a known fact that strong drink affects the mind. And even a small quantity of strong drink affects the mind. And once your mind is affected as a Christian, you are much more vulnerable as a Christian. And it's difficult to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and will and strength, if in fact your mental faculties have been diminished by drinking. I know some people who won't even drink cider on the grounds that it is alcoholic drink, and that however small the amount of alcohol, it interferes with your mental powers. There's a second suggestion by the scholars that in fact this total abstention is engaged in because it was associated with the heathenish rites in Palestine, and particularly the worship of the god Baal. The rites of Baal were, as they say, orgiastic rites, and involved a great deal of sexual immorality, and sexual immorality that was propagated by a great deal of drinking. And so not only did they abstain from drinking because it was linked to the rites of Baal and Baal worship, they refrained even from eating raisins, because it's a well-known fact, and you can find this right throughout the Old Testament, that raisin cakes were a well-known pagan offering to the god Baal, and particularly to the Queen of Heaven. And the Queen of Heaven was the great sex goddess of the ancient world, sometimes called Ishtar, sometimes called Astarte, sometimes called Venus, sometimes called Diana of the Ephesians. And so, in New Testament terms, the Nazarites were avoiding the appearance of evil. Now that's what the New Testament says Christians should do. We are to shun the appearance of evil. And the word, the Greek there that Paul uses for appearance is the word eidolos, which is the root, of course, of the English word idol. We are to avoid the idolatry of evil. Separation from, and a confession to. The second separation was a separation from cutting the hair. And I'm sure this is something that will appeal to some of the young men and ladies of our own generation, that throughout the Bible, long hair is a symbol of strength and vitality. You remember the story of Absalom and his magnificent shock of hair, of which he was so proud, vain fellow that he was, that he used to have it cut and weighed in public every so often, just to show the people what a fine and what an important and what a healthy fellow Absalom was. And of course it was the death of him. He was hanged in an oak tree by his hair. It's a symbol of strength and vitality. And some of the commentators say that long hair on a man is akin to the turban that was worn by the high priest. It was a crown of glory on a man's head. It was a diadem of beauty on a man's head. And it's interesting that the phrase holiness unto the Lord occurs in the chapter, because that was what was written on the high priest's mitre, on the high priest's turban. And the long hair was a confession to the world that our natural strength and our natural gifts and our natural virtues and faculties are to be dedicated to the Lord under the terms of a Nazarite vow. Paul says at the start of Romans 12 that we're to hand over our bodies as a living sacrifice. And it's interesting that he tells us to hand over our bodies. It's our bodies that he wants. James Philip was saying this week, we were discussing the passage, and he said, I'll tell you why God says bodies. It's because he doesn't want consecrated ghosts. Natural strength and your natural gifts are part of a Nazarite vow. And thirdly, there is a separation from contact with the dead and with the house of mourning. In fact, Nazarites were not allowed to mourn even their own relatives. In verse 7, neither for his father nor his mother nor for his brother or sister, if they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is upon his head. And there's rather a strictness in that law. If you look at verse 9, it's an indication of the seriousness of this part of the vow. If any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. In other words, he's got to go back to the beginning again. He has undone his separation. He's got to start all over again. And at verse 12, again, a measure of the seriousness of this. He is to separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation. At the end of verse 12, but the former time shall be void. He's lost his consecration. He's got to go back to the start because his separation was defiled. And that, the commentators agree, was a confession to the world that the Nazarites, even with their consecration, were living in a world which was under the judgment of God because of the fall. The wages of sin is death. But you see, death was not originally part of God's creation. Death came into God's creation from the outside. Death is an intruder into God's universe. Death is a burglar. Death is a usurper. And he's broken his way in through human sin to exercise his baneful reign over men. And so natural death, which is the death of the body, and spiritual death, which is the death of the soul, are part of our tragic universe and part of man's tragic condition. And the Nazarite's separation from all contact with the world of death was a confession to the world that they too were living under the judgment of God. These are the three separations and the three confessions. And the question arises, What are we Christians to make of these forms of separation today? Have they any relevance for Christian living today? Are they applicable to our Christian condition? And I believe they are. And there are two great and, I believe, permanent lessons for all believers. And the first is this. Now, these lessons are not particularly profound, and you must forgive me for being simplistic and a little naive. The first lesson is this. The call of God in the gospel is a call to consecration and separation. And I believe that that needs to be stated and restated today in large terms and in loud terms, because somehow many Christians today imagine that conversion to Christ is a different thing from consecration to Christ. In fact, you can even hear it said in some areas that salvation is a kind of two-stage thing. First of all, you come to Jesus, and then at some later point, you decide to consecrate your life to Jesus. Not so much a second blessing, because it's not called by that name, but a kind of second experience, a second spiritual decision, almost as big as the first decision to come to Jesus and follow him in the first place. A kind of two-stage salvation. But you see, to think like that is to misunderstand the gospel message and the whole thrust of the challenge of Jesus Christ. When Christ calls you to follow him, he calls you to a life of consecration and separation. And if the consecration and the separation are not there, what assurance do you have that you are converted to Christ at all? If you aren't consecrated, how can you claim to be converted? You see, the Nazarite separation wasn't simply a question of abstaining from specific things. The heart of it wasn't giving up X for the sake of God or stopping Y for the sake of God. A kind of consecration made up of bits and pieces. It wasn't just a question of giving up the drinking of alcohol. It was a question of separating yourself from everything that distracts you from a life of holiness and separation to the Savior. You see, it wasn't just a question of letting your hair grow long. It was a question of handing over the glory of your manhood and the glory of your womanhood for God's use and pleasure, for God to take what he wants, and for God to use what he wants, and for God to set aside what he chooses not to use in your life. You see, it wasn't just a question of not coming near the dead. It was bigger than that. This was a question of avoiding everything that belonged to the unhallowed world of death. Wrong habits, wrong relationships, wrong pleasures, wrong friendships, wrong company, wrong tastes. You see, the call of God to follow Jesus is not a bitty thing. It's not a thing of shreds and patches. things you do and things you don't do. It's a call to consecration and to separation. And if the call is temporary separation, as in this chapter, before going back to normal life, then it's still the same. I think it's very good for Christians to abstain from certain foods and certain drinks and certain habits and certain associations for a while. From time to time, I abstain from my friendships. I don't phone my friends, and I don't write them. I don't keep in touch with them for a while, because a friendship can become an obsessive thing. There are Christian friends whose friendship is a sickness. They're so obsessed with each other and taken up with each other. And as a mark of Nazarite detachment, it's good to be like the men and women in this chapter and separate oneself for a while. Or if the call be a lifelong call to the life of a Nazarite, then the qualifications are still the same. It's the call to have the spirit of a Nazarite. Do you have the spirit of the Nazarite in you? Is your life set apart for the use and the pleasure of Christ? Or are you hanging on, as some Christians I know are, to some vague spiritual experience that they had 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, which they call their conversion? And they're hanging on to that, and they think that's going to see them through. Do you have the spirit of a Nazarite? The call of God is a call to consecration and separation. And the second thing, I'm sorry to be so simplistic and so naive, please forgive me. It's this, that consecration always has outward visible signs. And in that sense, Christian consecration is a sacramental thing. You know that a sacrament is an outward visible sign of an inward spiritual reality. And where there is real consecration to Christ, there are always outward visible signs of the inward spiritual reality. I'll give you illustrations of this. I think most of us know that marriage is a vocation. Some people can best serve Christ for his use and for his pleasure in the bonds of marriage. And that is why God calls them to be married. But in precisely the same way, celibacy is a vocation. I thought it very shameful at the General Assembly, you know, when that young man stood up and proposed and said that the General Assembly should reaffirm the Christian position on sexual matters, the Christian position being chastity before marriage and absolute faithfulness within it. And he put forward that motion, and I thought it shameful that that lady minister from the Iona community stood up and voted against him and carried the day. And the General Assembly refused to carry that motion. In a city which is one of the AIDS capitals of the world. You see, just as marriage is a vocation, celibacy is a vocation, and it is a separation to the Lord, and the chastity is the outward sign of the inner reality, and the inner reality is a Nazarite consecration to Christ. You see, the Bible does teach that marriage is a vocation for some people, and celibacy is a vocation for other people. And some people are called to be married, and somehow they must cultivate the spirit of the Nazarite in marriage. I don't know how it's done, but then I'm not called upon to know. Some are called to be single, and they must cultivate the spirit of the Nazarite in celibacy. And I could speak to you about that. And I'm bound to say here that it would lead to far less frustration and bitterness in many Christians, just as it would lead to a lot more happiness and joy and fruitfulness if Christians learned to accept the Lord's calling and the Lord's vocation. You know, Paul has a great word on this in 1 Corinthians 7. He says, let every man abide in the vocation wherewith he was called. You can cultivate a Nazarite spirit in marriage. You can cultivate a Nazarite spirit in singleness. You see, you have to be what God has called you to be. Another illustration is the matter of total abstinence, which for some Christians is an outward mark of a Nazarite spirit. Not that drink of itself is wrong. The Bible does not say that drink is wrong, but it can be wrong for some believers, and it can also be wrong for some believers under certain conditions. And if you are out and about in the world at all, you'll know that that does become a problem if you have to mix with secular society. It's always something of a problem at a wedding when you've got deliberately to ask the waiter to go and find a soft drink for you and tell him to make sure that it's colored orange. I do have one friend in the ministry who used to boast from his pulpit that at wedding receptions he always made sure that the glass at the side of his plate held something orange, until I pointed out to him that that's not an infallible rule, because orange can be laced with vodka or gin. No, my friend, you would soon be able to tell if there was vodka or gin in his drink. Total abstinence is an outward visible sign, for some, of an inward spiritual reality. And abstention from certain pleasures and certain amusements, whether it's for a short time or for a lifetime, not because they're wrong in themselves, because they're not condemned by Scripture, but because certain pleasures and certain amusements can suffocate the Nazarite spirit in a Christian. And for the Lord's sake, and for the gospel's sake, they have to go. I'd like to read you some words written by James Eliot in his diary before he was martyred by the Auca Indians. You know that James Eliot was one of the mid-century martyrs who died trying to bring the gospel to this obscure tribe in South America. And this is what he writes about the need for Christians to have a Nazarite spirit. God makes his ministers a flame of fire. Am I ignitable? God deliver me from the dread asbestos of other things. Saturate me with the oil of the Spirit that I may be a flame. But flame is transient, often short-lived. Canst thou bear this? He wrote in his diary. Canst thou bear this, my soul? A short life? In me there dwells the spirit of the great short-lived, whose zeal for God's house consumed him. And then he finishes the entry in his diary with the great words of Amy Carmichael. Make me thy fuel, flame of God. That's the Nazarite spirit. Separation from things. Detachment from things. Paul said, of lawful things, I will not come under the power of any of them. That's the Nazarite spirit. And that's how Jesus lived. May I close by quoting a paragraph from James Phillips' new commentary on Numbers, which has just come onto the market. He's speaking about men who had the Nazarite spirit throughout the generations in Israel. Joseph and Samson and Samuel and John the Baptist. And he concludes his commentary on this passage in this way. He says, it can hardly be denied that there is a desperate need in the church today for such leadership, for men utterly given over to God for his purposes. Not men of fanatical zeal, which can very often be fleshly and often devilish, but men of controlled fire, men who can truly say with Paul, this one thing I do. Men of whom it can be said that the love of Christ constrains them, giving their lives depth and drive and direction in the service of God. And these fine words by James. The Nazarite vow calls us as Christians to a separation unto the living God that will make our lives and our ministries immensely significant in the divine economy. And he ends, there was another Nazarite, and he once said, for their sakes I sanctify myself, looking on a lost world. He separated himself unto God, unto the sacrifice of the cross. For their sakes, I sanctify myself. Think of your neighbors. Think of the street where you live. Think of the housing scheme you live in. Think of the town we all live in. And then say with Jesus, for their sakes. I sanctify myself. That's how Jesus lived, in the spirit of a Nazarene. That's how he lived. And that's how he calls us to live. Amen. May the Lord add his own blessing to the preaching of the word. To his name be the honor and the praise.